Algorithms of Trauma. How Facebook Feeds on Your Fears. Read by Daniel Stawczyk. 2 years ago, Joanna realized that something was not right. These ads for crowdfunding campaigns to finance treatments for children dying of rare diseases kept popping up on her screen. And then there were the news stories about morbid accidents and the articles on treacherous cancers whose symptoms doctors had ignored. Headlines like "Doctors say she has months left to live," before they made her believe it was depression, fed into Joanna's fear for the life and health of her loved ones and her own. She looked at her baby and wondered if there was a seed of disaster sprouting somewhere in there. And Joanna knew how unexpectedly a lethal disease can strike. Earlier, one of her loved ones had suddenly fallen ill and died of cancer. Ever since then, she had been battling an anxiety disorder, which Facebook only exacerbated. It was April 2021, with rough weather outside and reports forecasting unseasonable snow, when Joanna decided to take matters into her own hands. She contacted the Panopticon Foundation, which works to protect freedom and privacy in the digital world. This is how the case study entitled "The Algorithms of Trauma" began. With Dr. Piotr Sapieżyński, a researcher from Northeastern University who collaborates with the foundation, they decided to investigate whether the tools Facebook offers Joanna would help her escape the daily doses of horror. My name is Daniel Stawczyk, and you are listening to a special episode of the podcast Panopticon 4.0, The Algorithms of Trauma. This episode contains much information about the mental health of our protagonist. In order to protect her privacy, we asked another person to read out what she told us. We will also call her Joanna, although that's not her real name. 2021 was a difficult year. The pandemic raged across the planet. Our health became a matter of national importance. People were afraid to meet in person. They fought over face masks mandates and did their own research in virology at YouTube University. Traditional media published and discussed morbidity and death rates. Meanwhile, on social media, people speculated how many patients were dying because they had stopped seeing doctors for other diseases, out of the fear of COVID-19. Even those who had never been preoccupied about their health started worrying. Overwhelmed, they sought to distract themselves. And newsfeed algorithms complied, serving them Squid Game reviews, Bernie Sanders memes, and ads for the same fridge they had bought 2 weeks before. But Joanna's phone had something else to show her. Crowdfunding campaign ads for gravely ill children, alternating with offers of paid screening for the genetic diseases. Roughly, one in five of the ads she saw involved human health. From mid-May to late July, she viewed over 400 posts like these, 400 posts fueling her health anxieties within a little over 2 months. This could not have left her mental health unscathed.
I feel like anyone who got a daily dose of news on disease and death would probably get overwhelmed. But with people like me who have a particular tendency to worry about their health, it's exceptionally difficult because this is a factor that really cranks up the fear. The way it works for me is that when I see a post on Facebook where someone suffers from a disease, I find it hard to not take it personally. I just relate to it immediately. I start to scan my body, my brain shifts into higher gear. I analyze if I'm not having any of the symptoms myself. The same thing happens with stories about children's health. I start analyzing my child right away. And more often than not, I will find something to worry about. My anxiety goes through the roof and I get the temptation to learn more about the disease. So I start reading, Googling, researching online. This in turn probably causes Facebook to plant more and more of this information on my feed, information about diseases. And as a result, my fears escalate. The visions of disease seem more and more realistic, and I get the feeling that I should have it tested. I look up doctors, and I become on a downward spiral of fear.
As we listened to Joanna's story, we wanted to better understand what she was going through. We contacted a renowned psychologist, Joanna Vlies, who confirmed our protagonist's suspicion that a steady stream of such content would be damaging, even for someone in great mental health. A study conducted at the University of Arkansas found that spending 5 hours on social media a day significantly heightens the risk of suffering from an anxiety disorder. And not just in people with neurotic sort of personality type, but also in healthy individuals. I would say that no nervous system will remain neutral when faced with an excess of content centered around the loss of health and life. That's how we are wired. That's why we have survived as a species. If our nervous system grew lazy and decided, I am not going to react to that content anymore, then none of us would react to a car running a red light towards us. None of us would pay attention to the sounds we hear somewhere behind us while walking in the woods. This will never become outdated. The sensitive, active, I would even say reactive nervous system that we are equipped with, and the whole apparatus that protects us from threats, are a condition of our survival. Therefore, the expectation that we spend a lot of time on social media, scrolling through different news and terrifying content, will finally get used to it, is unrealistic. But let us go back to the beginnings of the case study, to the cold month of April, and to Joanna. When she joined the study, she was hoping that she could somehow persuade Facebook to replace the daily diet of dying children with ads for, say, exotic vacations or one quick kibble that even a cat could order, anything that would not give her anxiety. For the Panopticon Foundation, this was a great opportunity to test the tool that Facebook provides to its users, assuring them that they can impact what they see in their newsfeed. To understand this story, we need to answer the question, how does the Facebook feed really work? Well, it mixes content from three different baskets. The first basket contains the sources that we've picked ourselves, photos taken by our co-workers on vacation, posts by the influencers we follow, or the new menu of our favorite coffee shop that we have liked on Facebook. The second basket has ads, the posts others have paid Facebook to show us. The third basket lies somewhere between those two. These are posts that the platform picks specifically for each user, posts that it thinks will, here comes the keyword, engage us. Later in this episode, we will come back to what engagement means for social media. Now let's try to find out how much sway the users actually holds over what they see on their Facebook feed. Things are pretty straightforward with the first basket. If our downstairs neighbor has posted another selfie from his fourth beach vacation this year while we are getting rained on again, waiting for the bus to work, we can simply unfollow the neighbor. However, when it comes to the other two baskets, if we are seeking bleak, frightening content or even the kind that could threaten our mental health, like the post planted by Facebook on Joanna's feed, the issue is more complicated. We aren't the ones choosing these posts. It's the platform, or more specifically, its algorithm. In its first part, Panopticon's case study looked at Joanna's ads because they seemed more problematic to her back then. The foundation approached Dr. Piotr Sapiezhinski, who has been researching big tech and its impact on internet users for 11 years now. Most users stick to default settings. Nevertheless, the platform still lets the user set some preferences over what they can see in their feeds. We set out to find out if the users can actually rely on those settings to get rid of the content that they do not wish to see, for whatever reason. In particular, we worked with a user who has been exposed to a lot of content pertaining to road accidents, death and diseases. We wanted to find out whether she would stop receiving such content on Facebook if she used those settings to express her dissatisfaction. And in short, it did not work. As our user marked over 100 stories as content she didn't want to see, Facebook still pushed the same amount of distressing content to her feed. How does Facebook know what it should advertise to us in the first place? After all, there is no denying that whatever it recommends does provoke our response, although not always the kind of response we would like. Crucially, the platform gathers a lot more information about us than most users are even aware. The fact that we don't explicitly list our interests on our profile, upload any photos from karate practice or join ADHD support group is not an obstacle for Facebook. The platform does not have to count on us to deliver information, because it has given itself the right to watch us. Katarzyna Szymielewicz, an expert of the Panopticon Foundation, explains. Years ago, when most of us first entered the universe of online platforms, we were told it was a service not only free of charge, but also tailored to our individual needs. For many, it seemed too good to be true. And it was not true. In reality, we have been lured into a trap, a dangerous, unprecedented social experiment. Our behavior on online platforms is being tracked, observed, and analyzed to detect patterns. We are talking about statistical patterns in human behavior that show how people with similar characteristics react when they are recommended a piece of content or see an ad. Pattern detection may sound innocent, like science, right? But this is a very powerful tool. Algorithms developed by big tech companies detect and exploit our most sensitive characteristics and vulnerabilities, including our political beliefs, health conditions, but also fears and anxieties, things which we may not know about ourselves. When we enter social media platforms, we receive recommendations that do engage us. Algorithms are good at predicting what type of content a notification will trigger our reaction. But this is often negative and exhausting engagement. Certainly not what we had in mind when entering this place. You open the app to read recent news or catch up with a friend, and soon you end up watching clickbait content. This is why Szymielewicz believes that, to put it bluntly, Facebook treats us like biomass. First, all possible data is squeezed out of us. Next, conclusions on our characteristics and preferences are drawn so we can be presented such content that would maximize the sales of our time and attention to advertisers. Of course, Meta, the corporation that owns Facebook and Instagram, does not agree with this assessment. The company claims that its platforms respect the agency of the user, and the algorithms only follow the user's lead by recommending content that the user really wants, whether he or she realizes it right now or not. And the platform asserts it has proof of abiding by the user's will. Special tools that are supposed to give users genuine power over what they are shown. We decided to investigate these tools in the Algorithms of Trauma case study. The first tool is the user's list of ad interests, although the word interests might be misleading here. According to Joanna's list, her interests were genetic defects, oncology and cancers. It was as if Facebook had decided that browsing photos of terminally ill children was Joanna's favorite pastime. The list included as many as 21 health-related categories altogether. 21 categories that fueled existing fears and awakened new ones. Consequently, most ads Joanna saw took her to crowdfunding campaigns for dying children. Facebook had noticed, and aptly so, that they affected the young mother most profoundly. The fact that they aggravated her anxiety and worsened her mental health, apparently, did not matter. If you are curious what Facebook has decided your interests are, you can check the list yourself. First, click on your profile picture to see a menu, select Settings and Privacy to access your privacy center. There, click the tile that says you have options to manage the ads you see on Facebook. Next, if you click Review Ad Preferences, a window will pop up. Choose Facebook and Messenger off a list of apps, and the menu for your ad preferences will appear in a new tab. Then you need yet another click to access your ad topics, and another pop-up window finally takes you where you want to be. Phew! Finding your way around this independently may take a while. It took two of us 20 minutes. And it was not the first time we ventured into the depths of the platform. If you don't have the time or patience to wander around Facebook looking for clues, you will find the instructions on how to get to your list of ad interests in the episode description. Now that we know what Facebook means by interests, we can come back to Joanna. In June 2021, during the first algorithms of trauma study, Joanna manually removed all problematic labels that the platform tagged her with. Initially, the effects were promising. The number of problematic ads fell for about 2 weeks, and then the sick kid photos were back, their sunken eyes following Joanna from her computer screen. She returned to her interest list, and there, in the place of the oncology and cancer that she had deleted, were rare disease screening, intensive care unit, and other labels. Granted, Facebook did not restore the deleted categories to the list. Instead, it found new ones that fit the bill. Besides, no matter what left and what joined her interest list, the content and number of toxic ads ultimately never changed. When we completed the study after 9 weeks, the number of unwanted ads was almost the same as at the beginning. Joanna had no escape from this world of accidents and diseases. Admittedly, the platform itself warned her with disarming honesty that it may completely ignore the efforts of her trying to get rid of damaging ads. Today, the tool's description reads, "If you choose to see less of an ad topic, you won't get as many ads about that topic. The advertisers can't target you based on an interest in it. But you may still see some ads related to these topics even if you choose to see less of them. In other words, click all you want and we'll show you what we see fit anyway." Since our 2021 study, Facebook has changed the tool description and the promises it makes there. Previously, the platform said it enabled the user to delete some interests completely. Now it only allows them to see less of such content. Why does Facebook insist it knows better? We asked Piotr Sapieżyński to explain. What Facebook refers to as interests are really labels that the platform assigned to the users based on their behaviors. These labels can be then used by advertisers as a way to express they want to show their ads to users that are quote-unquote interested in things. For example, in specific diseases. These users never had to tell Facebook they were interested in such diseases. This is what Facebook inferred about the users based on their behaviors. So this is the first step in interest-based targeting. In our first algorithm of trauma experiment, we focused on these labels that advertisers can use for targeting. We noticed that our users were targeted by advertisers using a number of highly specific labels or inferred interests. She then disabled targeting based on these labels she found problematic. For example, those pertaining to parenting or diseases. And even though the advertisers could no longer use these labels to reach our user, she still received a similar number of ads whose content touched upon these difficult topics. In our second experiment in the series, we focused on the content that was not sponsored or targeted by the advertisers. This is suggested content, stories that nobody paid to show to the users, but instead the platform itself decided it was something relevant to show that would keep the users scrolling, and in turn create more opportunities to show these users more ads. When it comes to optimizing this type of content, the labels that we talked before are no longer available, but it turns out they are not even necessary. We no longer need a human readable description of what each user is interested in. Now it's enough that a particular user is in some way similar to other users that like a particular piece of content. The fact that Facebook doesn't really need to rely on these labels derives from what we saw in both of our experiments. When our user expressed to Facebook, she was not interested in all those diseases and deaths that she was being targeted by. That just meant she removed the human readable targeting labels. But the history of her behavior remained similar to other users who engage with this kind of content. And so Facebook kept feeding her these distressing ads. And now, in our second experiment, we see the effect of suggested content. Even without labels, Facebook infers that the problematic content will be relevant to our user. And so Facebook keeps pushing this kind of content. In other words, the interests aren't there for us users to manage. They're there for the advertisers to easily target their ads. If a company wants to promote its genetic tests, it can tell Facebook that it needs to reach people who are interested in cancer or oncology. And the platform will show the ads to such people. However, Facebook's algorithms has no need for attaching interests, or labels as Sapiezhinsky calls them, to its users. It operates on patterns and identifies similarities in the behavior of the biomass it processes, meaning it doesn't need to verbally characterize someone as anxiety-ridden to get to them through anxiety. In deciding which post to peddle to Joanna, all it needs to know is that Joanna behaves online like the other people that pause when they see a crowdfunding ad for a dying child. Behavioral analysis means that the algorithm can recognize all by itself what it is that keeps us engaged. This seemingly neutral word, engaged, contains a plethora of emotion, from joy to fear, from outrage to fury. In Facebook's world, engagement is measurable. It manifests in clicks, reactions, comments, or even where and how long we fix our gaze. If something pisses you off, it's engaging. If it frightens you, it's also engaging. Clearly, in the platform's vocabulary, our interests are not the things we like. They are the things that engage us, that push our buttons, no matter if they relate to our hobbies, fears or weaknesses. In one of his studies, Piotr Sapiezhinsky discovered an unsettling dimension of such targeting.
W innych naszych badaniach pokazaliśmy, że nawet na dużej puli.
In my other experiment, which involved a large sample of users, we showed that a significant fraction of all ads are not targeted at all. The advertiser just uploads an ad, sets the budget, and the platform has full control over who should see the ad. We see that even though these ads are not targeted, certain groups of ads predominantly reach certain groups of people. One example that we found in our latest work is that ads that are deceptive or contain clickbait are not targeted to anybody in particular, end up being showed predominantly to older users. This is because Facebook knows who is most likely to click on such content. Perhaps people with lower digital literacy or higher susceptibility to the deceptive content, and help advertisers reach these particular people. And this is again to show that targeting is not the only problem. Equally, it's what the platform does behind the scenes. The problem is what the platform does behind the scenes. Let's go back to Joanna. When she realized that she couldn't escape Facebook toxic ads, she thought the situation could not get any worse. How optimistic of her. Soon, it turned out that new trends in the social media industry would bring her more trouble. TikTok was gaining momentum, and the competition started copying its solutions to catch up with the new star. One such solution was an increase in the number of suggested posts. It was the hot summer of 2022, and Joanna's feed was flooded with headlines such as "Lawnmower kills beautiful 27-year-old. The family finds her teeth. Doctors sent him home. He was dead the next day. Stuck in the moving walkway. The tourist leg had to be amputated." Months passed and Joanna was again feeling besieged. Finally, in the spring of 2023, she contacted Panopticon again, hoping that their suggested posts would be easier to rein in, since they were not a direct source of revenue for the platform. Suggested posts are neither sponsored nor published by people or pages we follow. Facebook shows them to us because they engage us more than our neighbors' vacation photos, making us stay on the platform longer. And our time is money for Facebook, the opportunity to show us more ads. In late June and early July 2023, when adults were browsing last-minute vacation packages and kids were celebrating the beginning of the summer, the second part of the study began. First, researchers needed to check if Joanna was actually seeing a lot of problematic content or just remembering it most vividly due to her anxiety issues. In her case, suggested posts made up about 22% of her feed. Over a half were sensational headlines on gruesome murders and articles on deadly diseases whose symptoms were ignored by patients and doctors alike. Over a little less than 2 months, Joanna viewed 1,400 such posts, an average of 27 a day. 27 posts about freak accidents, severed heads, murders, bodies found in a dumpster every single day. Would Joanna be able to get rid of them for good? She was off to a promising start. Remember the search for her interest list that took us 20 minutes? This time, Facebook put the control tool for suggested posts in an easily accessible place. All users need to do is click the three dots at the top of the post. A miraculous change. The platform assured its users that if they choose the option "Hide posts, see fewer posts like this," it will recognize that we want to see less content of this kind. Everything seems transparent and easy to use. Encouraging, right? Hopeful, Joanna got to work. Within one sweltering June week, she hit 122 posts. This was supposed to send a clear message to the platform. I don't want to see this type of content again. After a week of consistent clicking, she eagerly awaited the results.
After a week had passed, I stopped clicking the button and waited for the results. There were times when I logged into Facebook with a hope that this would be the moment when my feedback finally translated into an effect, meaning that these posts wouldn't be there anymore. But that moment never came. And I've been told that the level or amount of toxic content changed this or that way throughout the study. Still, from my perspective, nothing actually did change over the whole period we were monitoring my feed. I mean, there was as much of this content as before, and the themes remained the same. What's more, like I've said before, it often happened that the posts were not only connected by the fact that they all talked about, say, cancer. Often I'd see a dozen or so posts over a week or two talking about the same freak accident or the same murder or the death of the same person. And I'd let Facebook know my reaction to a specific news story, like, I don't want to see more posts on X. Anyway, that's how I imagined the platform should interpret my cue. If I'm receiving information about a single murder case three different times and then three different times I click, I don't want this type of content, then at least I'm not going to get another post referring to that specific story. Well, it turned out that nothing worked, even at this level.
Ultimately, the ratio of toxic content did not diminish. In fact, the opposite happened. It slightly increased. The feed screamed, "Grisly accident on S7. 4-year-old dies after swimming in a pool. Tragedy at school lunch, 10-year-old dead." Joanna admits that the feature added by Facebook so that users can free themselves of unwanted content is a great idea in itself. Too bad that it doesn't seem plugged in. Consequently, rather than bringing relief and positive change, it breeds resentment and frustration. We asked experts why Facebook gave Joanna the option to communicate which content she didn't want to see only to ignore her message. Was this an honest mistake? Panopticon's Katarzyna Szymielewicz rejects the hypothesis out of hand.
Skoro firmy, które są właścicielami platform takich jak Facebook, TikTok, YouTube.
We know that companies that own large online platforms, Meta, TikTok, Google, are making huge profits. In fact, they are very open about that. And we also know that a major source of their profit is advertising. It means that large online platforms can ask a very good price for showing us sponsored content. Why do advertisers agree to pay this price? Well, it is believed that large online platforms have very effective tools to keep their users engaged, to keep them scrolling and interacting with content, which includes ads. And it really works. Billions of users across the globe spend hours every day glued to their phones, constantly connected to social media. Their addictive design is not a bug. It clearly is a feature which big tech companies monetize on stock markets. We have plenty of research from the last decade proving that compulsive scrolling does not make us happier, quite the opposite. Research shows that the excessive and compulsive use of social media is linked to sleep problems, attention deficits, and feelings of exclusion or anxiety. We should stop thinking about social media in terms of communication services. What they really are is gambling machines designed to make us addicted and come back even when we lose, when we experience stress, hate, and loneliness. Meta employs psychology and design experts to figure out how to stop us from putting down our phones. Psychologist Joanna Flies talks about the mechanisms that keep us glued to our screens.
Algorytmy będą nam podsuwały nie te.
Actually, if we have grown accustomed to some upsetting content, or if it only provides low-intensity stimulation, the algorithms will not offer it to us. On the contrary, they will plant the kind of content that is more likely to stop us in our tracks, more likely to make us pause our scrolling or even go back to something we've just seen. This means that the content will always induce fear, anger, maybe helplessness. Incidentally, the porn industry operates on the same principles. It serves people content that is stimulating enough to attract attention, and therefore makes other sex-related content less attractive by comparison. This is also the logic of clickbait. Today, if a YouTuber wants to be noticed, or if they want the algorithm to promote them, they must bathe their viewers with shorts involving emotionally charged materials. And of course, online news services have based their operation on that as well. What's more, the availability of such content is currently enormous, given that everyone always carries their phone around at all times. That's why we are now hearing more and more often that social media use various psychological tricks to build dependency in their users. The deceptively simple solution: if you don't like it, then delete Facebook or Instagram or TikTok or YouTube, is not that simple at all. We have woven these platforms deep into the fabric of our societies. That's where we now place neighborhood ads, promote events at our kids' preschool, or indeed run support groups. If a visit to such a group is preceded by an elephant dose of toxic content, it's like walking into an AA meeting and being handed a shot of vodka. We ask Joanna's point blank why, if it got so bad, she didn't just delete Facebook.
If it was that easy, I would have probably deleted my account a long time ago. Or if there was some viable alternative that wasn't doing this stuff, then I'd happily move over there. But I don't think an alternative exists right now. And the idea of quitting Facebook altogether is complicated for me. Because one, I need Facebook for many things related to my work. It's useful to me this way. And two, I'm not going to lie, I do find things there that are good for me. I'm part of parenting groups, support groups, including ones for people like me who battle anxiety issues, and they're actually really helpful. So I wouldn't want to give them up. If I deleted my Facebook account, I'd lose access to all of that. Having said that, it's not like I haven't considered quitting. I have, multiple times in fact. But ultimately I come to the conclusion that if I'm dealing with a service that has such a huge number of users all around the world, and that makes so much money on us, it's a little unfair to be faced with the choice to either opt out or use it and accept that being abused or being harmed comes with the package. To be perfectly honest, the reason why I decided to take part in this project is that I refuse to accept that our choice right now is reduced to that. And after all, it's not like businesses in other industries are allowed to just offer any product or any service they like. They have to meet some safety requirements. This gives us a sense of comfort that the products or services will not harm us. And consumers over there are not told, yes, the product is damaging, but you don't have to buy it. So what this mostly comes down to is Facebook should ensure at least a minimal standard of safety for its users.
More and more people like Joanna believe that rather than quitting a service, the provider should be held accountable for the product they supply. In late October 2023, over 40 US states filed a lawsuit against Meta. They allege that the company is aware that its product is addictive and damaging to the mental health of the youngest users. The suit centers around Instagram and is largely based on materials brought to light 2 years earlier by Francis Haugen that the media call the Facebook Papers. The whistleblower published the company's internal documents, which may suggest that Instagram's damaging effect, especially on teenagers, was even indicated by the platform's own research. Several weeks ago, another Meta whistleblower, Arturo Bejar, testified in Congress, confirming what Haugen had disclosed earlier. Meta has defended itself by arguing that the documents taken from the company only show part of the story, and Instagram consistently creates new tools to keep teenagers safe. Now, the company will have to prove that in court. European lawmakers have also taken matters into their own hands, believing that while better social media are possible, they aren't going to fix themselves. Since August the 25th of this year, we have been protected by the DSA, or the Digital Services Act. Katarzyna Szymielewicz hopes that this will be a breakthrough in the struggle against social media platforms for the user's dignity. She argues that the question is no longer whether we'll get more interesting or relevant content and ads, but whether we'll come out of this social experiment in one piece. According to the DSA, very large online platforms have to assess systemic risks caused by their services on a regular basis and come up with adequate mitigation measures. In other words, it is now the job of big companies to explore the implications of their business model for individual users and for society. We are talking about serious risks to mental health and well-being, public discourse, democratic processes, and so on. It has been very difficult for independent researchers to prove causality between the design of social media services, especially their recommender systems, and negative effects that are visible in society. This is because we don't have access to the inside data. But online platforms do. They can observe and prevent harm using exactly the same tools they now use to engage us. Algorithms trained to detect patterns in users' behavior see whether a particular user has fallen into a rabbit hole or keeps scrolling toxic, radical, or negative content. From the inside of these algorithmic machines, all these negative effects we are concerned about, from radicalization and polarization to mental health crises, are visible and could be prevented. The first round of risk assessments was due in September, which means that the European Commission is now digesting what it has received from very large online platforms, so-called VLOPs. And we are very much looking forward to their conclusions. In the meantime, we've observed that the VLOPs are experimenting with new features. Among other things, users can now switch to non-profile version of the recommender systems. They can also learn more about how these machines work. But of course, these changes are not touching the essence of their toxic business model. This is why we continue to collect the evidence of harm caused by recommender systems. It is also our role as the civil society to feed risk assessments with independent data. Until now, it didn't benefit the platforms to examine the effect they had on their users too closely or at least to publish the results. Unfavorable findings look bad, both externally and internally. But now the complacency of doing nothing has been taken away from the corporations. Risk assessment has become a non-negotiable requirement. Moreover, the DSA has obliged very large online platforms, or VLOPs, to implement a range of smaller changes, such as effective control tools, like the See Less button in Johanna's story. If the platforms provide users with such buttons, they simply need to work. The key thing about the DSA, though, is that online giants are required to construct their feeds in such a way that they wouldn't serve users harmful content in the first place. Thank you for listening to this special episode of Panopticon 4.0. Joanna's shocking experience and the algorithms of trauma are just a case study. We took a closer look at one user's story. But the US lawsuits and alarming reports from psychologists and educators suggest that Joanna's case is not isolated. We know from other research that social media have a negative impact on people with depression, body dysmorphia or disordered eating in addition to anxiety. If you also find your feed traumatizing, contact us on Twitter, LinkedIn or Mastodon. Every message adds valuable information on the problems caused by Facebook, which, according to the new European law, the company is now obliged to address. This episode of Panopticon 4.0 featured the case study subject Joanna, psychologist and therapist Joanna Flis, algorithm researcher Dr. Piotr Sapieżyński, and the president of the Panopticon Foundation, Katarzyna Szymielewicz. The script was written by Matylda Grodecka. Script editing and production by Maria Wróblewska. Content supervision by Dorota Głowacka. Expert consultation with Magdalena Birecka. Sound editing and post-production by Jarek Gawlik. Promotion by Dominika Chachuła, Aleksandra Iwańska and Anna Obem. Read by Daniel Stawczyk. This episode of Panopticon 4.0 featured the case study subject Joanna, read by Tania O'Carroll. However, if you speak Polish, we encourage you to explore the vast archives of our podcast. You can find more Panopticon episodes on popular streaming services and at panopticon.org. You can also subscribe through RSS in your favorite app. This was Panopticon 4.0.